Hello and welcome to Business Daily from the BBC World Service, the business podcast which brings you the trends, the money and the people who make the world and its money go round. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Welcome to Business Daily on the BBC World Service with me, Jane Wakefield, here at the TED Conference in Canada's Vancouver.
It is truly terrifying when you think of the speed with which totally malicious rumours and lies can be spread now and without anybody's knowledge. We really, really, really all need to be more scared and concerned and doing stuff because this is very dark times ahead, I think.
Fake news, disinformation, rumour spreading, political manipulation, whatever you call it, it's been the ongoing scandal that's rocked the world's biggest technology firms. In today's programme, I'm hearing from people involved in the heart of the story and others offering solutions to reset the online landscape.
We know that things like friction make a difference. So if you force people to slow down before they share, then actually people are less likely to share misleading or false information.
Last year, news broke that a previously little-known political consultancy, Cambridge Analytica, had got its hands on the data of millions of Facebook users without their consent. Those affected had no idea that taking part in a personality quiz on the social network would see their data and that of their friends potentially used for psychological profiling and political marketing. How much of that data was used to influence opinion in the US presidential election and the UK European Union referendum is still not clear. But the scandal exposed not just a lack of care towards the privacy of data on Facebook, but opened a debate about how social networks were being used to target voters and help spread misinformation.
So I'm Carol Cadwallader. I don't really have a title. I'm a reporter with The Observer.
You're now an investigative journalist. Come on, Carol, that's what you are.
I can't actually say it still. I'm an investigative reporter. You know, you always thought investigative reporters were, you know, these kind of like macho, hard-bitten men.
Carol was the British journalist who broke the scandal. And on the same day that she became a Pulitzer Prize finalist, gave a powerful speech about how what she called the gods of Silicon Valley had broken democracy. We caught up with her to ask how she saw the online world post Cambridge Analytica and the impact the story has had on her life.
I have felt this absolute mission to report this story and this sense of urgency and, you know, this need to try and communicate what's going on. But it has come at a cost in that it has really, really overtaken my life.
We have seen some quite systemic change at Facebook as a result of the things that you've uncovered or helped uncover. But I guess you still don't think they've gone far enough.
I would dispute systemic. I mean, I think they have tried to do certain things and they have tried to work at transparency. But it doesn't work. It's so easy to circumvent it. We see it in Britain. There was a group called Mainstream Network who were spending hundreds of thousands of pounds advertising for a hard Brexit. And so, yes, now we know that it was this group, Mainstream Network, who were posting those. Yes, we can see those ads on their page. But there was no way of knowing who that group was or where that money was coming from.
Let's break that down then, because there's two elements here, isn't there? There's the kind of where are these ads coming from, and then there's the content of the ads themselves and how much of it is misinformation. Have we just touched the surface of the problem?
I don't even think we've touched the surface of it. And the new and novel ways which are being invented all the time to distribute this stuff. I mean, it is truly terrifying when you think of what the speed with which totally malicious rumours and lies can be spread now and without anybody's knowledge. We really, really, really all need to be more scared and worried and concerned and doing stuff because this is very dark times ahead, I think. You know, this has been recognised by Parliament. So the committee which Damien Collins leads, the DCMS committee, this report they did was amazing. And they clearly say our electoral laws don't work anymore and these must be revised urgently. And then the government has just ignored the entire thing. I mean, so it's not, it isn't just on the, I called out Facebook and the social media platforms here, but it's absolutely us and our MPs and lawmakers elsewhere. you know, we are all in this, and there's responsibility in a lot of different places. What's so problematic or disappointing in Britain is that this is seen as somehow a partisan issue. It is not about party politics. It really is about national security.
What do you think is happening with Cambridge Analytica? Obviously, we've seen them close down. But one thing that the government reports seemed to sort of put out there was that this was just part of a much wider network of people collecting data, turning people's personal data into points that they could then throw back at them with political messaging. Do you think that we have stemmed that tide or not at all?
No, the opposite. I mean, I think now we have this little inkling of the idea of the way that this data, which we bleed online every day, is being collected and used against us. You know, these are the smartest, richest, cleverest companies and individuals in the world doing this. And they have all the power. And their power is increasing every day, because the more they know about us and the more we can be manipulated, the more their power grows.
Facebook has called for government regulation, hasn't it? It has held up its hand, and basically Mark Zuckerberg has said we do need governments to help us.
Well, I mean, I just don't buy it from Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, so yes, they want some little rules, which then, you know, so what? Few little like rules around the edges are not going to change anything. This is major structural systemic changes need to be made to this entire ecosystem. You know, the idea that having these three platforms, WhatsApp, Instagram and Facebook, all owned by the same company, I mean, start right there, that's hugely problematic. You know, they it's a monopoly.
Carol called on Mark Zuckerberg to come to TED and answer questions about Facebook's role in elections around the world. That did not happen, but Twitter boss Jack Dorsey was at TED. He was asked about the use of automated bots and the role they played in the recent election in Israel. He did not answer that question, instead focusing on how Twitter is attempting to tackle abuse and bullying. TED curator Chris Anderson asked him why it had taken so long to make changes.
Dial up the urgency and take, you know, move on this stuff. I mean, will you do that?
Yeah, yes, and we have been moving substantially. I mean, we are working as quickly as we can, but quickness will not get the job done. It's focus, it's prioritization.
Mark Zuckerberg hasn't answered your call so far to come and give his point of view at TED, but we did hear from Jack Dorsey. What did you make of his speech?
So, you know, when he was asked about the Nazis on Twitter, he sort of said Ku Klux Klan imagery, etc., is in breach of our rules and is banned. And you know, I tweeted, well, what's Dr. David Duke doing on here then? He's the ex-grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. He's all over Twitter. And we know that. Anybody who uses Twitter knows that it's full of this stuff. And, I mean, I found Jack Dorsey's talk absolutely chilling. There was a lack of emotional connection, which was really on display there. And, you know, people were asking repeatedly. And Jack Dorsey, that man who sat there with not a single expression on his face, is the man who's responsible in overseeing that.
Your speech has obviously had great impact here. What's been the response from Facebook to what you said?
TED said to me, we want to put the talk up online as soon as possible, which was amazing. And then they said, we've had, you know, Facebook have been in touch. They say that there are factual inaccuracies in it and they're going to respond and come back to us. And so I immediately did tick, tick, tick in my mind thinking, what's, and they said, well, they definitely did refuse to come to Britain, and there were 9 parliaments there who they refused to talk to, and they did threaten us with legal action the day before we published. And I said to the person from TED this morning, I said, what did Facebook, they come back with? And they said they didn't come back with anything.
You had, when Jack Dorsey gave his talk, it was opened up to people to tweet him and ask him specific questions. And I noticed that you did tweet him. You asked him about abuse, which is obviously a huge problem on Twitter. I'm guessing this is something very personal to you.
I had this thing from Leave EU, which is Nigel Farage's campaign, the Brexit campaign. And they did this video. So they took a scene from the film Airplane. There's a scene where there's a woman, she's getting hysterical. And so somebody slaps her around the face repeatedly, you know, walks up to her with a baseball bat, and then somebody comes up with a gun. And they doctored this. So they put my face into the woman's head, and they played the Russian national anthem on it, and they put it out on Twitter. And dozens of people were reporting it, like literally hundreds of people were reporting this on Twitter, and they refused to take it down. If this had been posted up in the street, then the police would have taken it down. We use Twitter and Facebook as if they're public spaces, but they're not, they're private companies. The way to discredit the stories been about discrediting me personally, and so I get all this sexist abuse. There was definitely a portion of people who did think, oh, well, she's just some ranting conspiracy theorist, because that's what propaganda does.
The term fake news is everywhere these days, but what exactly is it and who is spreading it? We asked Claire Wardle, an academic attempting to answer these questions.
A lot of this content actually isn't fake, and a lot of this content isn't news. It's misleading, or it's memes or posts, or so it doesn't actually describe the complexity. And at the same time, it's been used as a weapon to attack a free and independent press. And so when it's being used by politicians right around the world to describe things that they don't like, then I just don't think that the media or any of us should be using a term that's A, unhelpful, and B, has been weaponized.
In her talk, Claire described finding a balance between free speech on the internet and curbing the spread of misinformation as a central challenge of our times.
So, for example, people talk a lot about media literacy, which is teaching people to be more critical of what they consume. But actually, if we teach it in the wrong ways, we can make people really sceptical of all forms of information. We know that things like friction make a difference. So if you force people to slow down before they share, to make it harder, then actually people are less likely to share misleading or false information. But it's not in the platform's interest to build in that friction. So there are solutions we could do, but in many ways, we have to have the platforms on board to agree that this is something they want to take seriously.
Do you feel that that is a serious effort, or that they're just playing lip service to it because they've come under such scrutiny from governments and regulators?
It's very true that in the last 2 years, we've had a lot of movement from governments right around the world thinking about these issues. The problem is the scale of the speech that they're working with is just eye-watering. I mean, every second, millions of pieces of content are uploaded by people around the world in multiple languages, drawing on thousands of different cultural contexts. I mean, to think about building technology that can make sense of information in a computational way is actually very difficult. And I actually think what we need to do for Facebook is different from what we need to do for YouTube and et cetera, et cetera.
And is it also quite hard to really work out how influential this misinformation has been? That's a very difficult thing to measure, isn't it?
It's an incredibly difficult thing to measure. We have had researchers in the US who have said, you know, these ads didn't actually change the US election. But what we don't know is that somebody sees an ad on Facebook, walks downstairs to have dinner with their family and says, you're not going to believe it. And actually the strength of feeling when it comes from somebody that you love and trust is actually much more persuasive. This idea of a hypodermic needle, that if I see one ad on Facebook, I'm going to vote a certain way. That's not how information works. But I think what we need to recognize is that this is drip, 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 drip of misleading hyperpartisan content. The problem with all of this is that the people who are doing this, they're not breaking these systems. They're using these systems as they were designed to be used. And so that's what's so difficult in terms of coming up with new policies or regulations, because the Russian trolls who created content on Facebook, they didn't break the terms of service. I mean, they did create fake accounts to some extent, but it's very difficult to identify this content and to decide what to do with it, because people are just very cleverly using the systems that exist. So it is a form of hacking, but it's so clever because it's hacking what already exists.
Well, over in India, where elections are in full swing, the issue of WhatsApp rumours has become a very urgent one. Part of it is the lack of access to information through the internet in rural areas. And that's something that TED fellow Gangadhar Patil is trying to correct. He set up 101 Reporters a few years ago to try and reach the parts of the country lacking in coverage.
We aggregate grassroots reporters and stringers, network them, source original stories from them, which we edit, customize and market it to international publications like Nikkei, like Ozzy, and other homegrown publications in India. In last couple of years, not less than 1,200 reporters have lost jobs. And with that, publishers are highly dependent on contributors because they can't afford to hire full-time reporters in smaller towns. So now that reporting has restricted to big cities, we have been successfully able to network some reporters in Pakistan, Nepal, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and we're able to get stories from there as well. So everybody wants a reporter on the ground, but nobody can pay for that.
So give us an example of some of the stories that have come out of your kind of network of very rural reporters that perhaps otherwise would have gone unreported.
We did one of the stories from Pilbhit in Uttar Pradesh, which is a northern state of India. The story was about a local stringer who is doing video stories and disseminating them through his WhatsApp network. And it's a subscription model, and he's also able to make some money out of that thing. This was a positive story that we did for a local tech platform. It was picked up by most of the publication. We have reported more than 2,500 such stories from places which were never covered by mainstream media.
You mentioned WhatsApp there, and India does have a problem with WhatsApp and fake news.
So this has become big in the last couple of years, mainly because of the digital revolution. You have free data, and then the mobiles are so cheap that everybody in the rural India can afford. You know, everybody started using it, and since so many people are there on the platform, there are groups, political groups, mostly behind this fake news with a propaganda, with an agenda to swing the votes and generate some kind of hatred in the community. So you are trying to polarize the vote by either making it anti-Hindu or anti-Muslims or anti-Dalit. There are in fact factories of fake news who are constantly working on this, and they didn't realize what does it mean when you forward it to hundreds of friends and family. A lot of incidents have happened. People have been killed. There was mob lynching. There are riots that have happened because of the fake news. The government has reached out to WhatsApp, to Google and Facebook about if they can do something about it. But yes, I think until people become aware of the impact of such forward, it won't stop. And this has been a big issue about in India. So hopefully now things are getting under control, but still there is a lot of things to be covered.
Well, that's all from today's Business Daily from me and producer Sarah Trenor in Vancouver.